Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. We've been hearing for months now that the economy is in recession, but there doesn't seem to be any real consensus among economists. How about we force them on stage for a round of Name That Tune?
We're singing the same song. The song is that the U.S. economy is weak.
Well, that's not going to be a top 40 hit, is it? If the economy is so weak, maybe it should take a cue from our Sean Cole, who spends a good chunk of change pepping himself up for the workday.
I don't have enough room for all of these energy drinks.
And good luck to American tourists at the Olympics, who may not have enough room in their suitcases for all the junk they're buying.
This is knockoff city, stalls upon stalls of fake Gucci bags and Rolex watches.
It's all coming up on A Genuine Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. Inflation rose last month at the fastest pace since 1991. 1991. Let's see. First Gulf War. Crumbling Soviet Empire recognizes independent Republic of Georgia. Lakers lose the NBA Finals. Somebody should go check on Mount Pinatubo. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com.
The morning news is a ritual for lots of us. Gotta understand what's going on out there. So you're checking out the headlines. Inflation just gets worse and worse. And wait a minute. Really? We're not heading into a recession? Wait a minute. We are? Blame those economic surveys. Sometimes they just confuse the heck out of everything. So we invited a couple of our favorite economists to help decode what is up with these studies. Diane Swonk is chief economist with Mesirow Financial in Chicago. Welcome, Diane.
Good to be here.
And Michael England is chief economist for Action Economics. He's in Boulder, Colorado. Hi, Michael.
Hello, how are you doing?
Doing well, thank you. So I want to ask you about a couple of headlines that we've seen recently, both dealing with surveys that were done of economists to talk about how the economy is doing. And one was from USA Today. The headline is "Fewer Economists Believe Recession Likely." Yay, right? But in Bloomberg, the headline was "Slump in U.S. to Worsen as Consumers Get Squeezed." Explain the difference to me, Diane.
Actually, a lot of us overlap. So in all fairness, it's us. We're all talking together. We're singing the same song. The song is that the U.S. economy is weak, and whether or not it statistically qualifies as a recession, frankly, is kind of irrelevant because it feels like a recession to a good majority of people out there. And the situation is going to get worse before it gets better. So, you know, technically, we hit 2% close to growth, maybe a little higher with revisions in the second quarter. But that's kind of dismal considering it was supported by $150 billion in tax rebates. And we're not too happy about how little we've been able to achieve with so much stimulus.
Michael, would you agree that this is a bit of semantics? You know, are we in a recession versus a bad economy where consumers don't feel very nice?
Well, I do think semantics are a big part of it. I think there's also some different patterns going on in the economy at the same time and maybe some confusion in the part of different people's views on what a recession is. Early in the year, I think a lot of people knew bad things were happening, and I think they threw the term recession at that. And in fact, there are a lot of very negative things happening to American households. The surge in commodity prices and oil in particular going into this year was pretty dramatic, and it really drained real purchasing powers of most households. So to a lot of people, if you are going to decide whether we are or not in a recession, that's sort of enough. But to economists, the real key is there a broad downturn in the economy? And that's where I think we're running into sort of a brick wall with the statistics, because most of the data are showing that the economy is actually still on a positive growth path. So we've got these sort of dichotomies working in the market.
Well, Dan, let me ask you about these surveys themselves. What good does it do for us consumers to hear from you, economists, whether we are in a recession?
It does matter in terms of policy decisions. I mean, you don't want to make a policy decision to cure the ills we're facing today if the consequences of that cure cause a greater disease down the road.
Michael, how do these surveys work? Do they just call you up and say, hey, how you feeling?
Well, economists do maintain projections on the economy and track all the various indicators. So when you use these survey results, it shouldn't so much be seen as an attempt by economists to see the future. is really to describe what the best guess is of the landscape and what the real risks are to policymakers and to bond market and currency market investors, let alone helping the public have some sort of sense of why conditions around them may be getting better or worse.
So it's not entirely surprising to either of you that we would have one survey headlined, fewer economists believe recession likely, and then another that says the slump is going to get worse.
Well, they're two different things. A slump is a slowdown in growth. A recession is a decline. So the number of people who actually think there's going to be an out-out 2 quarters of decline has gone down, but the number of people who think there's going to be really weak growth has gone up. They really are consistent. I know that sounds strange. I think the more important issue is what Mike points out is economists are often asked the wrong questions. What economists are good at is hedging risk. It is a sort of conscience that's not very popular in Washington to have an economic conscience.
All right. Well, let me ask you each a final, very short question. Diane, do you think that we will go into a recession?
Gosh, I think we're 50-50 now. I don't have a recession technically in my forecast, but who knows what they'll do and revise it. I think we're close enough that the majority of the American public will feel like it because the unemployment rate will be rising, which just is a lousy environment.
And Michael, what's your prediction?
Oh, very similar to Diane's. We are above 50-50. We do think that the economy is probably going to skirt recession this year. The risk we think is 2009, but the real downturn in the economy that would drive that decision actually is a downturn that hasn't occurred yet.
Well, Michael and Diane, thank you so much for joining us. And how about we check in with you in, 6 months and see how your predictions panned out. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com. And by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about the economy at Gather.com. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation, online at kauffman.org.
This week, Morgan Stanley and J.P. Morgan Chase joined a growing list of banks agreeing to pay millions of dollars in settlement money over auction rate securities. Now, we've talked about these before on the program. They're bonds whose interest rate is reset through a special auction. Lots of people invested in them, but then they couldn't get their money back when the credit crunch hit. The Marketplace's Bob Moon has been following this story. And Bob, remind us why folks thought these were a good bet.
Well, these bonds were pitched as being as good as cash. Let's say you had a big wad of money and you wanted to invest for a short period of time. This was supposed to be one of the safest and easiest ways to do that. It was almost like making a little free money, certainly a better return than a savings account. But the promise was you could still get your cash out when you needed it.
And not a promise that was followed through on.
Yeah, whenever Wall Street offers to serve up a free lunch, get ready for a bad case of indigestion. There was always supposed to be an auction market for these things. In fact, for years, the banks would step in and buy if there weren't any other takers. Then that all froze up early in the year. There were no buyers for these bonds. The banks then had their own credit problems. Suddenly, people couldn't get their money. Now these bonds are still worth their face value if they're cashed in when they reach maturity, but investors have been complaining, hey, that's not what I was sold.
So we have this settlement now. How are people going to get their money back, and who will?
Well, the jousting is still going on, but the white knights are out there. You may have heard talk this past week that some kind of global settlement was in the works to provide an industry-wide resolution of this. Well, so far that hasn't happened. State and federal regulators have reached formal agreements with just a handful of banks, Citigroup, UBS, Morgan Stanley, and J.P. Morgan Chase, which includes former Bear Stearns customers. They're all going to buy back a combined total of around $35 billion worth of these auction rate bonds from individual customers, small to mid-sized businesses, and charitable organizations. These buybacks will pay the face value for these bonds.
Well, the way you explain it, basically people are going to get back what they had originally. But what about any losses that they've incurred because they couldn't get their money out?
Well, yeah, people might have had a down payment on a house that they were penalized for or late taxes or something like that. You might want to consult a lawyer about this. There's also been a special arbitration process set up for any of these consequential damages.
Does this settlement say anything about banks you shouldn't be doing this anymore? That you're not going to be able to promise things that you can't follow through on?
Well, I think that's why they are giving these refunds, to protect their own reputations. They're doing this primarily for their retail customers, the customers who deal with their own brokers. And the brokers have been putting pressure on these banks to settle up.
What about non-retail customers?
Non-retail customers, that's a still outstanding issue. There are a lot of corporations, some pension funds, those sorts of institutional investors who are still standing in line waiting to see if they're going to get their money.
All right. Marketplace's Bob Moon. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Tess.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Our economics editor, Chris Farrell, is here for the audio op-ed we call The Straight Story. And Chris, hard to believe, but we're about a year out from kind of the first real indications of the housing bust, the credit crunch. And, you know, I have to feel sorry for a lot of the folks who did everything right. They got good mortgages, and yet they are now caught with home equity lines of credit that they can't use, and they can't get loans.
No, and they were very prudent because they didn't take out, what, option arms or those liar loans. But they've been swept up in this downturn in the economy and, quite frankly, the collapse of the housing market. I think collapse is probably the right word to be using these days.
So is there anything that could help them at this point, or are we just all paying for the mistakes of a few?
Oh, we're all paying for the mistakes of a few. Look, what's going on right now is to stem a collapse in the economy. You can't stop the housing market from falling. That's not going to happen. So what we're seeing is a lot of effort by the regulatory authorities to stem this decline, and we are all participating in it at this point in time.
We've heard a lot about this idea of moral hazard, where, you know, Wall Street and banks all took all these risks that they shouldn't have, and now they're getting bailed out. And so are, frankly, some homeowners. I mean, why would people who were prudent next time around not just say, you know what, I'll go ahead and take the risk because I'll get bailed out later?
Okay, there's a couple of things. I can't stand this term moral hazard. Look, there's a couple things going on. Life isn't fair. I know it isn't fair if you were prudent and you're watching some people getting bailed out that weren't. But the real lesson to take out of this is that if you were prudent and you have savings and you listen to this radio show, you are going to have the opportunity of a lifetime to buy the home that you want, to take advantage of falling prices. Because remember, at some point, this market turns around. So prudence is its own reward. You don't want to be one of those people that's going through foreclosure. You don't want to be one of those people that's doing a short sale. You don't want to be somebody that is sitting there thinking that I'm going to have to declare bankruptcy. It's no good. It's hard to crawl back. It's tough on your family. So just sit back. If you were prudent, don't be greedy, but you will have an opportunity. And that is fair.
The Straight Story with our own Chris Farrell. And Chris, we'll talk to you later in the show with a few questions for you in Getting Personal.
Oh, I love the questions.
All right, well, here's a question, not for Chris, but for you people who buy and slurp can after can of stuff called Rockstar and Reload. Do massive doses of caffeine and sugar give you wings or something else?
Between that and the energy drinks we're about to feed you, you're going to float home.
That story and a follow-up on last week's story about healthcare data mining, coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tessa Veglund. Now, I'll be the first to cop to a $4-a-day Starbucks habit. Grande, extra hot, non-fat, dirty chai. The host of a personal finance show should know better. But at least I don't have Sean Cole's habit. Energy drinks. At $2 a pop, and most junkies have at least 2 to 3 a day, if not 5, you're looking at what, $50-$60 a week? It all adds up to predictions of more than $9 billion in sales by 2011. We asked Sean to do some splaining.
I've been through Red Bull, Rockstar, and Vega Steez, which is an organic green tea drink. And this is the perfect blend of all of them. Trader Joe's store brand. Lots of caffeine, not too much sodium. Organic evaporated cane juice. Yum. And not long ago, on a routine stop at my local Trader Joe's, my heart broke.
So the sign says, soon to be discontinued. Stock up now.
So I did.
8, 9.
And then I called Traders and asked them why they were ditching my favorite product. It's not selling, they said, and they wouldn't say anything more. Jeffrey Kleinman had the same problem.
You know, a lot of retailers are pretty closed. Trader Joe's, I couldn't even get anyone on the phone over there.
Jeff edits Beverage Spectrum magazine, one of two mags published by BevNet.com. The whole Trader Joe's thing made me wonder if energy drinks had finally reached, and there's no way around this, market saturation.
I think the year of the 100% growth in energy drink sales is probably about done, but that's because the category has matured. You know, it's hard when you're already selling $4 or $5 billion worth of product to double to $10 billion, you know, unless you're selling bombs.
Can we stop for a second?
Yeah. He wasn't
feeling very alert. Had scallions in his lunch. We walked over to maybe the most expensive espresso machine I've ever seen.
Between that and the energy drinks we're about to feed you, you're going to float home.
Weird energy drinks, brands I'd never heard of.
We've got Rhinos. We've got one called Ego.
I tried one called Baza.
Oh, wow.
And then moved on to Rumba, which is an energy juice.
That just tastes like juice with sugar in it.
Oh, no, no. Bottoms up.
Dude, you're trying to kill me.
Jeff says Rumba was an attempt to push the energy concept onto the breakfast table. You've got companies marketing energy beer now. And back in June, Starbucks released Double Shot Energy Plus Coffee, which presents the question, isn't there enough caffeine in coffee? But Starbucks says it's not just about the caffeine.
Consumers told us that they wanted this product.
Mark Rooks is marketing director for the North American Coffee Partnership, which is to say Starbucks and Pepsi. They put out the product together.
And it was a really viable way for us to continue a dialogue with a really important consumer demographic, young adult males.
And while I'm no longer young, Starbucks was kind enough to send me every flavor of their new drink. Original coffee, mocha, and vanilla. And then I started to freak out. All of these drinks have sugar and sucralose in them, along with ginseng and, of course, caffeine.
Do you all have trouble sleeping ever?
Not at all.
But America does. Or rather, we don't sleep enough, about 6 hours and 40 minutes on average, as opposed to the recommended 7.5 to 8.5 hours. But Sean, I hear you cry, I don't even have enough time in the day to drink an entire energy drink. Well, there's an answer. Jeff Kleinman?
Energy shots.
The little tincture-sized drinks, like 5-hour energy, Jeff says they could be a $500 million industry by the end of next year.
5-hour energy has just blanketed the airwaves in the past couple of years.
Why are energy drinks bad? 12 spoons of sugar? That's bad. 200 calories? Bad. Guarana? Tisk, tisk.
Good for Guarana is a tropical berry that has more caffeine in it than coffee. You'll see it in a lot of energy drinks. And it's the main ingredient of this one drink in particular called
Balls.
That's B-A-W-L-S. They sent me a bunch of samples, too.
I don't have enough room for all of these energy drinks.
Balls was created by Hobie Bupert. I asked him about the name of the product, I mean.
So it's a reference to the bounce of energy that it gives you.
So you didn't mean testicles at all?
Absolutely not.
Okay. Hobie launched Balls before Red Bull hit the United States. And it's still a big hit among video gamers and paintball players. Still, I wondered if all of the new competition bothered him. He said no.
At least a lot of our media competitors, at least in the past year or so, have gone out of business or bankrupt, so that's left us in a pretty good position.
Plus, Balls is good. Thing is, it's really just a highly caffeinated soda. No vitamin B, no supplements, but as Jeff Kleinman ominously told me,
I don't know what you're exactly looking for in your buzz, Sean, but I can tell you that there's something out there that will meet it.
Maybe. Until then, though, I've still got 6 Trader Joe's energy drinks in the fridge. Not including this one.
In Boston, I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace Money. Oh my God, that's good.
Sugary drinks aren't the only thing that get folks' hearts racing. Last week, we ran a feature from Marketplace's Steve Henn. He told us about private companies that compile our prescription drug records and sell them to insurance companies, which then use the information to help determine whether they'll cover you. One of our listeners wrote in to ask how this was legal under federal medical privacy rules, known as HIPAA regulations. So we've brought Steve back for some answers. And remind us first, what exactly is HIPAA?
Well, HIPAA is the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, and it was largely designed to give consumers more control over their healthcare records.
So it's really all about privacy.
It was largely about privacy. It sort of laid out when and how people could share your medical information and when they couldn't. My impression was that HIPAA had sort of taken care of all this.
But apparently it hasn't.
No, it hasn't. What insurance companies are doing is writing in a HIPAA release into your application. So if you apply for life insurance or health insurance, that fine print includes a HIPAA release. And that release is how they have the legal right to go and search these electronic records.
So I know you dealt with this a little bit in your piece, but let me ask you again. How does the average person know that they're signing away their privacy rights to their prescription drug records?
Well, there are only two companies that do this, and one of them didn't return my calls. But the folks at MedPoint said people should be aware when they apply for insurance that that's going on. Their insurance company should make it plain to them. But, you know, in reality, I think you and I have both signed credit card applications, mortgage applications, and you often don't have the time or capacity to read and understand everything you're looking at. One thing that consumers can do is to go to these firms and write them a letter and ask to check your pharmaceutical records. So just like Chris Farrell tells everyone to check their credit rating, it might not be a bad idea if you're worried about who's looking at your medical records to check with these companies every year to see who's checking up on you.
But then I suppose the question is, what do you even do with that information? Because frankly, if you want to get the health insurance or you want to get the life insurance and they're demanding that you hand over these prescription drug records, I mean, you got to do that in order to get the insurance, right?
Yeah. And honestly, that's not that new. It's just the process of how it's done has changed dramatically. It wasn't too long ago that my wife and I had kids and we got life insurance. And part of that process was signing a HIPAA release and going around to our physicians and physically helping the insurance underwriter collect our medical records and review them. Now, that's a really labor-intensive process, and that's one of the reasons that insurance companies like this new system better, is it's cheaper and faster. But the old way also made it more difficult for a bad actor to go around and fake it.
Well, thanks so much for coming back, Steve. Good stuff.
Thank you.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com. Marketplace Money is supported by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
All right, it's time for Getting Personal when we turn the microphone around and hear from you. And joining me once again is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. And Chris, you ready for your first email?
Absolutely.
Okay, well, this first question comes from Dorothy. She lives in Oakland, California, and she is among many, many listeners who have written in recently to talk about the free credit reports that the government has designated all of us to be able to get. Last week, she went to the website, annualcreditreport.com, and it turned out to be a huge hassle for her. Experian and Equifax, she says, weren't too hard to deal with, but then when she tried to get through to TransUnion, they said that she needed to print out a form and mail in the request. So she tried going to the website directly, but they didn't mention anything about the free credit report. But finally, she managed to get all three reports, but there was no option to order the score. So, Chris, maybe first we need to kind of explain the difference between a credit report and a credit score. These are really two different things, right?
Oh, absolutely. Your credit report is your history of that credit card and do you pay it on time, or that mortgage payment or your car loan. What the credit score does is it takes that information and it gives you a number that says you're credit worthy or you're less credit worthy.
Now, she says she went to annualcreditreport.com, and what happens when you do that, I actually did this recently, is that it opens up new windows to get you to the three credit reporting agencies. But I don't know. Perhaps this was confusing for her. Maybe she closed a window or something?
It could be. I'm curious if other people have had a problem, because I've gone to it too. And as long as you stay within the website and follow their directions, and of course there's always this issue about the amount of information that you're giving up. And if you look at their, what is that, frequently answered question section, you know, clearly that's upsets a lot of people. But stay within that website. The one thing that you don't want to do is if you start having trouble, then you go, well, I'm just going to go to TransUnion. I'm going to go right to their website and deal with them. Then all of a sudden, you've just created a lot of unnecessary problems for yourself.
If you've got a question, do visit our website. We're at marketplace.org. Click on the Getting Personal link there. Or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And let's go ahead and go to the phone line. Zach is with us from New York, New York. Hi, Zach.
Hey, how are you doing, Tess?
Good, thanks. What do you do there in the Big Apple?
I work in a university library.
Ah, well, so then you know everything, don't you?
Well, hardly. I work at an arts library, not in an economics library, so
okay.
That's why I'm lost.
Well, we've got the economics library here with me. Its name is Chris Farrell. So how can he help you today?
Hi, Chris.
Hi.
I am looking at making an unexpected move sometime within the next couple of months due to a situation with a roommate. And I'm awaiting the lecture from you guys. I don't really have any savings.
Oh, Zach. How is that possible? I mean, how old are you?
26.
26, and you don't have just a ton of money saved up yet? I mean, really.
Well, I understand. But the difference is I don't have any money saved up.
Okay. How was that for a lecture, by the way? Was that pretty good?
Yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah. I feel admonished. But the situation is this, is I know I'm going to have the moving expenses, and so I know it's going to come to at least a couple of $1,000 I don't have.
Okay. And in terms of this regard, probably the easiest, quickest, simplest loan is, do you have a credit card?
Yes.
That's going to be your best loan for the purposes of the move itself, for getting the rental truck. Plus, you get some protections when you use the credit card. So it's usually sensible to use your credit card when you are renting a truck. I mean, and then in terms of the moving in expenses, you know, the security deposit, the 1 month's rent, that you're just going to have to, a little exaggeration, a diet of ramen noodles for the next month or two to get that set aside, because that they're going to want cash.
Okay.
What about just a personal loan from a bank?
Well, do you belong to a credit union, Zach?
I do not.
Okay. Quite frankly, I don't think that he would get a personal loan from a bank. Credit union, there is a chance that he would get a loan from a credit union, but not a bank.
Okay, well, that's good to know. Then I guess it's ramen noodles and or beg mom and dad for a favor and a loan.
You know, the Bank of Parents is a good bank.
Yeah.
And if it is a possibility for you, Zach, there are ways that you can really set up a very business-like arrangement.
Oh, fantastic.
And I think that's a great way to go. And Tess is absolutely right. There are these websites, and they will charge you a market rate of interest, so then they don't get any trouble with the IRS. But there's no fees, there's no costs, there's no reporting to the credit bureaus, any of this type of stuff, the sort of ancillary stuff that goes with making a loan from a bank.
And then you'll start building that savings account, right?
Exactly, yeah. As, you know, because New York's just getting cheaper with each passing week.
Oh, I'm sure it is. All right. Well, good luck to you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And now we're answering your questions every weekday online at marketplace.org. Just click on the Getting Personal link there. And stay tuned for more Getting Personal later in the show. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This week, the flagship company of the famed Sydney Opera House announced its upcoming season amid something of a scandal. According to the Sydney Morning Herald, one of the country's noted mezzo-sopranos accused the opera of sliding into, quote, an abyss of mediocrity. Crikey! Well, on this week's A Day in the Work Life, we meet a performer who has no such issues singing for his supper.
I'm Richard Troxell, and I'm an opera singer. When people hear the word opera singer, they have an image of a really heavy person, or they still think, where's your spear and where's your helmet with horns? I remember first singing when I was 4 years old. I sang in my church, I've sung with my mother, and probably the first song I can remember singing, or my mom singing to me, and my dad sang too, was the "Say, say, little playmate, come out and play with me, and bring your dolly three, climb up my..." And I remember singing ever since then. I had great formal training. My undergraduate degree is in theater. Then I went and got a master's degree at Converse College. And then I went from there to the Academy of Vocal Arts in Philadelphia, which was the best thing that happened to me. Really great teachers who we could spend 6 hours a day rehearsing. Finding a job as a young opera singer, it's a lot of networking. It's just kind of like being a young intern in a corporation, apprenticeships or whatever. You find a mentor, and you find someone who really wants to take you under their wing, then teach you a technique of using your voice that's going to be able to project, because we never use a microphone. And that's the big difference about opera singing and any other type of singing. Opera singing is one of the riskiest forms of making an income, because not only do I not get paid when I'm not working, I'm not paid when I am working unless I make do the performance. So if I go somewhere for 6 weeks and rehearse, and I catch a cold and can't go on, I don't make a penny. I am the typical, I would say, class artist, a good year, 200,000, a not so good year, 60,000, 70. My first professional job was in Cleveland, singing La Traviata, and here's a great debut, is because I am going to sing at 10 o'clock in the morning for the student performance. I am not a big morning person. I don't do caffeine. I drank coffee that morning, which may have been the second cup of my whole life. And I come out in the third act, and I came out to sing "Obiobiolata," which is a big, long high note. And I held it way too long, and I fainted. I woke up to 3,000 high school students laughing hysterically. I was so angry and so determined. I got up and I said, "Mi dispiace, maestro. I'm sorry, maestro." I said, "Ancora. I'm going to do it again." And I walked off stage and I sang it again, longer and louder. And the kids screamed like the fallen football player who gets up and does the next play. It was one of the most exciting operatic performances ever. The advice I give to young singers or to young performers is, you do what your heart tells you to do. And if you think you can do it, then you do it. It's not a burden.
A Day in the Work Life was reported by Judith Ritter. To see and hear more from Richard Troxell, check out our website, marketplace.org. And while we're on the subject of performance, have you checked out your foreign portfolio recently?
In terms of declines and negative returns, it does look pretty bad. It's a global bear market.
But don't fret, there are a few good places left to invest on the planet. That story's next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. Some Americans are lucky enough to be watching the Olympics in person, and they'll see several sides to China. The shiny Olympic Park on one hand, a few blocks away, the gritty underbelly. Marketplace's Scott Tong tells us the shopping experience reflects different sides of China as well.
Shopping Trip 1, an official excursion hosted by the Olympic Media Center. On an air-conditioned bus, our guide welcomes us, and we're off to the White Peacock Art World. This is where you buy a traditional Chinese something to bring home and display. A rug, a painting, a carving. Looks like a giant museum gift shop. The jewelry lady slides open the cabinet to show me a jade pendant. $100. All the prices here are listed. I smile and walk away. She smiles back.
Ms. Yang Jinxiu is a Chinese male minority artist.
Upstairs, a local artist demonstrates painting with beeswax. $70 for an original.
Bye-bye.
And on the way out, we all get a gift box with a jade frog inside. All in all, a very civilized, non-invasive experience.
Hello, do you want to buy t-shirts?
Now to the south side of town, to the tourist trap known as the Silk Market. This is knockoff city, stalls upon stalls of fake Gucci bags and Rolex watches.
Yeah, it's a polo.
My friend Paul Salo is eyeing some khaki shorts. How much? Salo whips out a calculator in pecs.
190.
Okay. This is a good quality.
About $30 is the opening price. Let the games begin.
We're gonna go cruise around.
No
first.
Handbag, okay. Pick, look,
2 minutes in, we're down to $20.
Okay, 100 you want to buy for now? 100. No hard chance.
And then 15. We walk away. She starts shouting after us. $12, 7. Paul Salo stops.
What do you think? $5 for a pair of shorts?
We turn around to go buy the shorts and try to confirm the price. She shushes us. Don't tell the other customers the good price you got. So we walk away feeling pretty good. Although Beijing veterans say folks like Paul probably paid double or triple the local price. Maybe they should rename the silk market the fleece market. Well, here's the nicer way to look at it.
We bought six propaganda posters.
Edward Felsen of Los Angeles is in town for the Olympics. He and two buddies ventured into a tchotchke stall, got roped into a bargaining session that ended up with 8 purchases.
And there's like there's some with like a sickle. There's one with like Nixon, I think, getting stepped on.
Felsen knows they probably got ripped off, but the buyers and sellers all walked away happy. And by the way, he's converted to bargaining.
We should start a negotiation process at the local mall.
Felsen's friend Chris Lobrunner wants to take it even further and start negotiating during Public Radio Pledge Week. In Beijing, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace Money.
There's one place in China not feeling the Olympic love. The Shanghai Composite Index has lost more than half its value since the start of the year. And it's not the only foreign market experiencing big losses. So much for the advice to diversify by investing overseas, right? Andrew Ang is a professor of finance at Columbia's Business School. And Professor Ang, are stocks as depressed abroad as they are here?
Many international markets have experienced, in some cases, some severe declines. Emerging markets have got hit, and some of the most popular countries to invest in, including China, India, are now off their peaks of around 50%. In terms of declines and negative returns, it does look pretty bad.
So the rest of the world has indeed entered a bear market.
That's right. It's a global bear market. Now, one of the reasons why you want to invest internationally is so you want to be exposed to many different sources of value. And you want to be able to invest in countries that don't necessarily move the same direction as the U.S. So in other words, when the U.S. goes down, you would like to find an asset that insures against a decline in the U.S. and, in fact, goes up when the U.S. goes down. Those assets are very valuable.
But it doesn't seem like that's what's happening right now. The U.S. is down, and so is the rest of the world. So how does international investing help you at all in this situation?
Research has shown that even though countries tend to go down together, in the long term, international investing is still a very solid thing to do. These bear markets actually are really a short-term focus, and they average out, and so that in the long term, these effects will go away.
What is behind some of these significant drops on, for example, the Hang Seng in Hong Kong, the Bombay 500 in India, the Shanghai Composite? All have lost huge amounts of their value over the last several months. Are the reasons the same as what we're seeing here in the U.S.? They didn't have a subprime problem, right?
No, some of these countries certainly did not have any subprime problems. But there are some common themes that have lended these countries to decline together. One of them is increasing inflation across the world. Commodity prices and the increase in those commodity prices have also impacted many emerging markets, in particular those countries that are very export-oriented, like China and India.
So that would be everything from oil to the food crisis?
Everything from oil to food to also cost of transport, everything.
So what advice do you give to the average investor, you know, someone who's got a 401k or perhaps has dabbled in the market through mutual funds and took the advice over the last couple of years to diversify into the rest of the world and now is seeing that that really served them no better than investing in the U.S. markets?
For a long-term investor, you want to be exposed to as many different assets as possible. And international investments, in particular emerging markets and the new frontier markets. So these would be countries in Africa and the smaller countries in Southeast Asia. And you want to be exposed to them in the long term. You shouldn't be tweaking your portfolio to sudden changes, short-term changes in severe declines.
So much akin to the Dow or the S&P 500, these markets will come back as well?
These markets will certainly come back. These markets constitute a small fraction of the world right now, less than 10%, but this is where all the growth is in the decades to come.
Andrew Ang is a professor of finance at the Columbia Business School. Thanks so much for your help today.
Thank you very much.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters. And by saveandinvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence by providing unbiased financial information, tools, and more. Online at saveandinvest.org.
We are back with Getting Personal, and with me once again is our very own Chris Farrell. And Chris, our next question comes from Heather, and she is in the City of Lights. And by that, I do not mean Paris. She's with us from Las Vegas. Hey, Heather.
Hi there.
How are things there in Vegas?
Oh, dare I say hot.
Well, what's your question for Chris today?
Well, my son is a performer here in one of the Las Vegas shows, and...
Wait. What kind of show are we talking about?
Yeah, They make the quick assumptions when thinking about Las Vegas. He's in one of the Cirque shows at the Mirage.
Ooh, wonderful.
Oh, boy.
Is that the Beatles show?
It is, yes.
I've seen that. It's wonderful.
It is pretty spectacular, I will say.
How old is he?
He's 8.
Good for him. Is he hoping for a career in show business?
Yes, actually, if you ask him, he wants to be an actor for the rest of his life.
Well, so are we talking about his money issues or yours?
Well, we're talking about his money issues, actually. His income has, I would say, doubled the household income, but we don't need it. So I would like to wisely invest it somehow for his future.
Yeah, well, boy, Chris, we've got an 8-year-old who's making quite a nice chunk of money here. Should all this be going to college or maybe a little bit for fun?
This is really wonderful because you have a real chance for him to build some wealth. First of all, I do think the Roth IRA is a good idea. And boy, when you just think about if he's 8 years old, pulls his money out at 65, and all the gain is tax-free, that's really an incredible opportunity. He wants to be an actor, but an education is still a really good thing. It's something to fall back on.
Chris, it's not often where we tell people that their college education will be the fallback plan.
I know, but, you know, he's got, I mean, look, he's already in the Cirque. He knows what his career is. He wants to be in the show business. So, yes, the college is an insurance policy. And, you know, he doesn't have to put aside much, but, you know, maybe a little bit into a 529 college savings plan.
Is he there? Could we talk to him?
Yes, he's actually very excited to talk to you. Just a second.
Hello.
Hi, Mason. How are you?
Good.
Are you a big Beatles fan?
Yeah. Once they got in the show, I just... Those are one of my favorite bands now.
So what do you want to do with your money?
I want to save most of it for a house and for college. I might get some to my mom.
Oh, what would you get for your mom?
Well, I think at this point it's gas money because I wanted to hire a driver to take him to and from work every day.
Well, there's a role reversal, isn't there?
I know.
All right. Well, thanks so much for calling in. Enjoy this time. It's very, very exciting.
It is exciting. Thank you so much.
You bet.
Have a great day.
Well, you know, Chris, we're not performing nightly at the Sands, but we are available anytime to answer your personal finance questions. Give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or write to us. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on the Getting Personal link there. All right, Chris, let's reach into the email bag. And Amy writes in from Rochester, Minnesota, and she's wondering about something called a stretch or legacy annuity. Someone is trying to talk her elderly mother into buying one, and she hasn't been able to really find any kind of information anywhere. She's a little concerned about this. Should she be?
Not necessarily. So what it is you're passing along the tax-deferred allowance to a beneficiary. The reason why you would do this is because when the person dies with the annuity and the heirs get the money, you know, they got a big tax hit. by passing along the tax allowances, there's a lot more tax flexibility.
Anything suspicious about someone trying to push her into this, or is that just business as usual?
I think that's business as usual. There's a lot of pushing of annuities right now. And the simple reason is we live in an environment where everything seems to be going down. And so annuities are being peddled as a safer product. And you just can't be seduced by that. You got to say, well, is this right for your mom?
Well, unfortunately, those are all the questions we can take for this week's show. But Chris is now answering your personal finance questions online every weekday. And that's no stretch for him. Just visit our website, it's marketplace.org, and click on the Getting Personal link. You can also call us at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Chris, thanks as always for the great advice.
You're welcome, Tess.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Believe it or not, it's been almost 3 years since Hurricane Katrina. Next week, we'll take an in-depth look at the personal finance issues that still plague New Orleanians trying to rebuild their lives. Today, we get an overview from Allison Plyer of the Greater New Orleans Community Data Center. I met her a couple of weeks ago at a construction site on Tulane Avenue and asked her to describe our location.
Well, this neighborhood's right in the center of Mid-City. It was definitely, you know, mixed to lower-income neighborhoods, sort of low on homeowners, a lot of housing that wasn't in very good shape. Not the poorest neighborhood in the city at all. We had a lot of poor neighborhoods. But this neighborhood, like 50 other neighborhoods, got about 6 feet of flooding, I'd say.
So that would explain a lot of the boarded up buildings that I'm looking at around here.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, a lot of folks with less money have not had the resources necessary to come and fix their properties.
Are there still people who are waiting to return to New Orleans?
Well, there are certainly still people who are waiting to return to New Orleans. I think, you know, some people who have very few resources will probably always hope they can return to New Orleans and may or may not know how they can make that happen. But, yeah, I think we can safely assume there are people who are waiting to return to New Orleans.
And what are they waiting for?
Well, on the very low end of the scale, there are folks who are waiting for them to redevelop the public housing. These apartment buildings are not public housing per se, but they'll have some affordable units. But almost all of our public housing has been closed down since the storm. Some is up now. About 2,000 units out of 5,000 are now back online. But the others were demolished all the way down to the ground, and it's going to take a couple years before they all get back online.
What about other issues in housing for perhaps those who wouldn't necessarily be going into public housing, but there's still a lot of problems, aren't there?
Absolutely. And, you know, we definitely should not focus too much on the people who are in public housing, because that's only 5,000 households out of maybe 80,000 that were had to be displaced because of the storm. So the middle-income folks have definitely felt the pinch from trying to come back. The folks who have been able to come back the fastest were the people who had their own resources, not only just insurance, but money in the bank. Because if you had money in the bank, you could start rebuilding your house right away without even waiting for your insurance settlement. So those clearly were the people who came back first. And then the folks in the middle, you know, area there, they have had probably the hardest time. They might have had insurance, but maybe it wasn't enough to cover the cost, because the costs keep going up. Month by month, year by year, the costs go up for rebuilding your house. And that is a huge problem. The insurance rates have... it's hard to estimate exactly, depends on what kind of house you had, but they may have doubled, which can be a huge obstacle for people who might be wanting to come back. Some of the property tax assessments have increased, depending on what kind of house you had and where, so that has been an obstacle for some people. So people in the middle incomes have really, really had the pinch in terms of trying to come back.
What about public transportation?
We now have about 20% of the buses running that we did before the storm. And actually, that was only about 17% until a couple weeks ago. We got 9 new buses, and we have this interesting story about those buses. We were negotiating with FEMA about getting our buses replaced, and what FEMA does is they only give you the same buses that you had before the storm. So we had to find decrepit old buses in California that matched our decrepit old buses. And then when we were going to go buy them, they realized, oh, but yours had air conditioning, those don't, so we got to get air conditioning. They were going to retrofit them with air conditioning, and then suddenly the whole deal fell through. California couldn't wait any longer, sold them to somebody else. And finally we said, come on, man, it's almost 3 years later, can we have some new buses? So we got these 9 biodiesel buses, and we're about to get a total of 37, which we're excited about, but that's out of hundreds. And we still have so few, and ridership... like around the country in the last few months, has really gone up here. And so it's going to start to become a pinch for everybody now to have those buses.
How long have you been back?
I came back a month after the storm to see if my house was flooded or not, and it was. So, but I decided to sell it so that I could just keep working, because that's what I do.
Well, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
That was Allison Plyer of the Greater New Orleans Community Data Center. Next week, we'll take a close look at the financial struggles of residents trying to bring back the Big Easy. For them, it is far from easy.
I am the only person back on my block, and we're almost at a 3-year mark.
One of the big decisions? How far to elevate above flood level.
I believe that if I raise my house 9 feet, that I can evacuate, leave everything in the house, and it'll be here when I come back.
But good luck getting the money to do that.
You've got these deadlines hanging over you. They're government deadlines, and government is saying you can't do what is necessary. It's nuts.
Marketplace Money is produced by Nancy Fargali, with Stephen Hoffman, Eve Troh, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Viglund. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com.
American Public Media.